Welcome to the Northern Business Podcast, a regular discussion with people in the north of England who lead businesses, employ people, and they've got new ideas to help our economy grow. Northern Business Podcast is produced by Recognition PR, and we serve scores of companies in different sectors, some of which occasionally contribute to this programme. Now, we're kindly sponsored by Virtue Motors, which is one of the top automotive retailers in the UK, with a network of dealerships representing some of the world's most popular brands. It also owns the successful commercial vehicle retailer Vans Direct. I'm Graham Robb, and today I'm presenting with Jamie Collis.
Hi, nice to see you.
And in the studio, we've got Hilary Bevan, who's director at Bevan VAT Consultants. And down the line, we've got Andy Ramsbottom, who's director of Global Strategic Accounts at S-Code. And we'll hear all about these businesses soon, because they're fascinating, actually. Into the nitty-gritty.
Looking forward to hearing more.
But we've had a really interesting few days in the last week or so, haven't we? All the similar things that join up.
Yeah, it's been very sort of energy-focused, basically putting our energy into a lot of things. But we were both working at a conference, Northeast Critical or Future Resources Conference, which is all about critical minerals, and how the critical minerals that are available, particularly in the north of England, are going to enter the energy supply chain, things like battery storage and batteries used in EVs. That sort of fits very nicely with what's going on today and this week, which is COP29.
Yeah. And if we just look at the critical minerals conference first. I was privileged to be asked to chair it, but I certainly had to do my homework, because when you really get into the nuts and bolts of it all, finding these critical minerals is essential to the future prosperity of countries. And China has bought up a lot of the critical mineral supplies in the world, both in Africa, South America, and in China itself. And there is a rush to get them. And EVs are really a totem for it, because they use lithium and magnesium and cobalt in the batteries. But it isn't just EVs that use this. It's battery technology in households, from robot lawnmowers to battery storage. There's a huge demand for it as the world electrifies.
I think out of all those countries that you mentioned, the UK has a very, in comparison, very small amount of deposits. However, what it does have is enough to allow us to generate our own industry and not rely so much on imports, which is always a good thing for any economy. Mm. So that was really interesting to hear how these companies are looking at extracting it, not mining it. That's a really important thing to say as well, to extract it, to find ways of bringing in, things like lithium out from water underneath the hills in the north of England. That's really fascinating to see how they're doing it, that in a green way, to help a green industry.
Yeah, they're calling it brining, not mining, which is the line. I think you might have come up with that line, but certainly you've been pushing it, haven't you? They're taking the lithium out of deep geological wells, which were discovered in the North Pennines and in Cornwall. And there was a lot of information about the government's National Wealth Fund, which is being used in Cornwall and might elsewhere in the country as well. And then the other interesting element of that was the cost. Of course, like oil, the mineral has to be valued at a certain price to make it worthwhile extracting. And the extraction facility in the North Pennines, they're talking about maybe extracting £1.6 billion worth of lithium over the lifetime. But that only equates in tonnage to 10,000 tonnes. So it is a very valuable commodity.
It certainly is. And it just shows, again, not just for EVs, but for battery storage, particularly in things like people's homes. And there was one presenter who talked about a town in Scotland, about how they could transform this one town by moving away from gas and putting in battery storage, air source heating and all that sort of stuff, all that requires this sort of materials. Obviously, you know, that's very topical this week with what the government announcing in terms of boiler, ending of new boilers in homes and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, so let's look at that. COP29 is on in Baku, and Keir Starmer has said he wants to get to 81% of 1990 emissions, so reducing it by 2035. There's also this government is pulling forward to 2030 the EV mandate, which talks about electric cars, not petrol. And then they're also introducing a date now of 2027, so only 3 years' time, when all new homes will have to have air source heat pumps or some non-gas heating. And that's quite an ambition.
I think all this is important, don't get me wrong, but it's all happening very, very quickly. And there may be a case of more haste, less speed to be able to do some of this. You know, they're talking about building 300,000 houses.
Mm.
Is there going to be the infrastructure there to be able to power these houses? Not just electricity connections through the network, but battery storage capabilities, plus all these EV cars are there. Is there the infrastructure for that? So the ambition is great, don't get me wrong, but you've got to do everything.
And I think the thing is, with the political climate, we just had Donald Trump, who won in America, and he's going to drill, drill, drill for oil. But he also is going to stop the EV mandate and say it's up to the market to decide whether it's EVs or whether it's petrol cars. And you can't suggest in this climate, in public circles, that some of the targets are wrong without being accused of being a climate change denier. I certainly am not a climate change denier, but I want us to get there in a sustainable way without pricing people who can't afford an EV off the road, or pricing people who maybe just need to repair or replace their boiler into a more expensive heat pump. It's got to be done with consent and with the ability of people to afford it.
Definitely. It's certainly going to be a challenge.
It certainly
is. For that. But we could talk about this.
We could. Yeah, we got to talk to our guests.
So we got to talk to our guests. That would be rude. They've come all the way to talk to us today, so it'd be great to introduce them again. So, Hilary, thanks again for being here. So you're director of Bevan VAT Consultants. Give us your 30 seconds elevator pitch. What does your business do?
So, yeah, thank you very much both for having me. It's really great to be here. So what Bevan VAT Consultancy does is what it says on the tin. Helps mainly accountants, but also individual businesses with any VAT question they may have. So it might be, we've bought a pub, we're converting it into flats. How much VAT should we pay on the work? Can we get that VAT back? Do we have to pay VAT when we sell it? It might be someone who's developed a new food product, a flapjack or something. Is it 20% VAT because it's confectionery? Is it zero rated because it's food? And because I work with lots of different firms of accountants, it's different every day. So, and I'm trying to persuade everybody that they need to embrace the love for VAT.
Could we be having the Jaffa cake conversation?
Yeah.
Could we be having the Jaffa?
You can't talk about VAT without mentioning Jaffa cakes, can you?
Well, welcome to Andy Ramsbottom as well. Now, Andy works with Escode. I'm not going to try and explain it, but once you do, people will realise how fascinating it is. Tell us about Escode and where are you based as well?
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I've been with NCC Group for 20 years, and I've already made the first mistake there by saying NCC Group. We're at Escode, which is part of NCC Group and the software division of NCC itself. And Escode is the world's leading and largest provider of software escrow solutions. And indeed, we are pioneers of that service. And for those that are listening to this podcast, be familiar with the National Computing Centre in Manchester that was on Oxford Road, adjacent to the BBC building. That was where we were born out of. We've since moved our headquarters, still in Manchester, but we provide our services across 35 offices globally and work in 135 different countries. And so what is software escrow? Well, it's a way of ensuring the continuous availability of critical third-party software applications. And we achieve that by acting as an independent third party, sitting between the developers of a piece of software and then the end users themselves, to mitigate the risk between vendor failure, essentially.
Escrow is an American term, and anyone that's bought a house in America, not that I have, but my daughter has, and she was explaining how escrow works. And it's basically a safe harbour for both people's assets in terms of buying a house, their money. But in terms of a business, their data is now a tangible asset that needs to be protected and harboured.
Absolutely. And it's those critical assets that a business might not necessarily have access or ownership to that they would need in the event of a third-party failure, for example. You made a reference to data just there, but most importantly, and what we handle, is the source code for third-party applications. And the source code, in its simplest terms, is the building blocks of a software application. So those organisations, be it a financial institution, a supermarket, anyone that's using a piece of software, they will not have access to that source code. And if in the event of a third-party failing, they would need access to that and the intellectual property behind that. And Escode holds just that in escrow.
In my experience from doing quite a bit of work for clients in the PR world on corporate finance transactions, we normally talk about the advisors that are working there, which is normally CF specialists and lawyers and stuff. But I was reading some stuff say that you're also involved in sort of the M&A process as well, in term and the validation of that when it comes to private equity and VC investment in these companies. So how does that work with that source code and that software?
Sure. It's in the M&A world, they use our services, more of our technical consultancy services, to do the due diligence of the software that they would either be acquiring or merging the two companies with. So one of our skills is that with our in-house team, we will work with the developers of the organization to capture the knowledge behind how a piece of software is written and built. So as documentation around that as well is key. I think with the private equity and the VC world, that goes back to sort of the inward investment of capital around into typically sort of software developers, where they seek the investment to grow the organization, to go from to tender for new contracts. But the VC or private equity will want to guarantee and have some safeguarding around that investment. So if certain milestones or repayments weren't made, then they would at least have access to the intellectual property and the assets of the application to continue running that, and then have something to monetize against it. So it's something that's always been there, but more prevalent now, I would think, in what we're seeing in the market.
What are the threats that this software faces? Because you talk about M&A, but there's a guarding element to it as well, isn't there? With the source code, huge damage can be done to major corporations and the country's well-being. So are you able to guarantee? It must be, you're like a bank, really, a big safe deposit box.
Yeah, a lot of what we do is I'm talking here about eventualities that we hope never play out. You know, we're talking about supplier failure and deterioration of service and so forth. But what we continuously are doing on a daily basis are playing out these scenarios of the worst case. And we are testing those processes and giving confidence to whether it be the investors, whether it be the software developers, whether it be the end users that are using it, that the event of this failure, that you'd have the confidence that you can recover and stand up the running of that application itself. The most interesting shift we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years or so is we've predominantly always worked with on-premise software applications. The elevation of cloud and the hosting technology has meant that we've now had to sort of develop and evolve our services. And with partnerships with the like of AWS and Azure, we've been able to do that to give confidence that no matter how sort of small or large a software enterprise is, that they can still have access to that system in the event it was to fail.
So AWS, Amazon Web Services, that's the big, huge global monolith. Business couldn't really operate without AWS, could it, really, in so many ways? And they have had problems recently. There was a major...
Our service is more centred around using the technology there to stand up the applications that are written and deployed into an AWS environment. I think the point to emphasise there is that historically we developed our products and tools for on-premise systems in-house, whereas now we take counsel and work in partnerships with some of the world's largest cloud service providers like an AWS.
And is it something that keeps you up at night, thinking about the deliberate attacks that go on, hackers and state players now, particularly state players? This is the kind of resilience that somebody like you people will turn to and hope that you're able to be the saviour of the day. You know, you're the stormtroopers of the data, really.
Yeah, I can say my two young daughters keep me awake at night more than that sometimes, but it is something that I think actually just emphasises the unique place of where S-Code sits. As I said, we're part of NCC Group, of which is split into two divisions, a cyber division and the S-Code division. And although they are two very different organisations, they complement each other very well, because the S-Code division is working around long-term availability of applications at source code level and working with the software developers. But then with our cyber colleagues, they're working there to make sure that systems are secure, safe, and always available as well. So the two do knit together and complement each other well, but certainly that certainly plays into the various different levels of expertise that we've got in-house to work towards or to have in a secure environment.
Andy, you obviously got a lot of expertise in-house, as you said, but how do businesses access the expertise? Do they have to come through a third-party supplier, someone, or can a small business work with you, or are you working just for these giant retail and and huge, huge, well-known household names. What kind of business is getting your service?
Yeah, it's a good question. So essentially anyone. I think we've currently got about 50,000 live contracts in place, wow, working with 7,000 software developers, ranging from tier one global financial institutions right down to sort of very niche, you know, privately SME type sort of firms. But if we look at the sort of the autumn statement recently in regards to what was pushing out regarding those seven key markets, I think our unique place is that we cover each one of those. And if I try and knit together what I've tried to describe in this sort of very brief session with you now, is that the investors and the software developers and the end users have all got an interest in terms of where investment is going to go here. And with that, with the emphasis being on breaking down barriers to adopting new technologies, you see local examples of small SME software houses seeking investment to then go and win new contracts. And we worked on one recently where a local to us in Manchester software house sought investment from an investor to go and bid for a large supermarket contract and won it, to give the supermarket confidence in the long-term availability of the application that we got the investment from. So, you know, it touched on everything there, you know, sort of household names, SME software house, and corporate investment.
Well, Andy, look, thanks for joining us. I think of another question to ask him?
But... No, I think he's coming back. I'm taking it all in. It's really, really good. So I'm going to turn to Hillary.
I feel safe and secure knowing you're there. That's all I can say.
Definitely. So, Hillary, let's move on to VAT. Obviously, we've just had a budget, which I'm sure we'll come on to. But before every budget, there's always calls from different sectors saying this VAT rate needs to be lowered, this VAT needs to be changed. Do you think the current thresholds help or hinder businesses at the moment?
What is it, 85?
It went up in the, not the budget we've just had, but the one in April, the last Conservative one. It went up from 85 to 90,000, which was not really worth the paper it was written on. I probably have a different view. I think VAT specialists tend to have a different view from non-VAT specialists. I think the threshold should be lowered, because when the Office of Tax Simplification did a fantastic review in 2016, and there is a huge number of businesses who are trading just below the VAT registration threshold. So if you're a one or two person business, you can make a fairly decent living turning over just under £90,000 a year. So if you're going to lose suddenly a sixth of your income by going over the VAT threshold, you don't have that incentive to grow. So there's lots of businesses who don't take on an extra member of staff because their turnover will go over the threshold. Yeah. They might not take on an additional contract. They might close for a month every year. They might stop operating a day. And it's artificial. It's affecting how businesses work, and Hillary, tax shouldn't do that.
I remember this from when our PR firm, I founded it 37 years ago. And, you know, for 5 years, I managed to stop registering for VAT. And ironically, all of my clients were business clients, so they could claim the VAT back. And all it did was to stop me having to fill the VAT forms in. But at that time, I had these big green VAT books, and every time I wrote an invoice, I had to write it out by hand. I remember having my first VAT inspection, one of the most terrifying things that I've ever had in business.
Yeah,
because
that's still the same.
VAT inspections, and I was literally scared stiff. And I got a good room. I had no problems.
Well, that's
I had no problems.
Good today.
But, and so I agree with you, for businesses that trade with businesses, because when I actually registered for VAT, I managed to claim back VAT on loads of the things I'd bought.
Yeah.
And you automatically think about the bureaucracy of it, or the artificial way in which you may have to increase your prices or what have you, but actually you get it back.
Yeah, and it's definitely harder for businesses who are trading with the public rather than B2B.
Yeah, if you're a painter and decorator, that's very different.
Exactly, then you can't necessarily put your prices up by 20% just because you've VAT registered. But at the moment, you could have a painter and decorator who's earning 85,000 a year is actually in a better position than one who's earning 90,000 a year, because the second one has to VAT register. Mm. And that doesn't feel fair. Whereas if we lower the threshold, so most businesses are caught by it, it would even the playing field. It would be a lot fairer. But coming with that, the system would need to be simplified, because you talked about the hassle of becoming VAT registered and what you had to do. Yes, some of it is more straightforward now, because a lot of the accounting software will calculate the VAT return for you, as long as you put your sales invoices in, you put your purchases invoices in, it'll do it. But even just the process of registering for VAT, 2 years ago it took 2 days, now it takes a minimum of 2 months.
Yeah.
And
it well, that's very interesting. I didn't know that.
No, I didn't.
It's absolutely ridiculous. Just HMRC are so under-resourced. So registering for VAT isn't something that should be complicated. Mm. That should be very straightforward. And it's causing businesses no ends of difficulty. If you think of the private schools who are now having to register for VAT, they've only got 6 or 7 weeks till that kicks in. I don't think they're all going to be...
Yeah, and that, by the way, that is something that where customers flash up the Daily Telegraph from today, the day we're recording this, and you'll see that there's already been more pupils leaving private schools than was predicted as a result of this increase in fee.
Yeah, and it's difficult, I suppose, because you're always measuring on what might happen, and you don't know how many are going to move. You don't know how many might have been moving anyway. You don't know how the schools would adapt. So some schools have said straight away, if there's VAT on it, we're just increasing all our prices by 20%. Some have said we'll actually absorb some of it, because, as you said, you can get the VAT back on your costs once you're VAT registered. So you don't have to put your prices up by 20% to cover all of it. Some have said, we'll wait and see. but it's getting quite close to the deadline for wait and see.
Can I ask you a few pop quiz questions that I've had to encounter in my business life about VAT? How far back can you go once you register to reclaim things that you've bought?
So it depends if it's goods or services. So there's a rule on pre-registration input VAT. So input VAT is the VAT on your purchases. Mm-hmm. So services that you have bought in the 6 months before registration, you can get the VAT back. For goods, it's actually 4 years, as long as you still own the goods at the point of registration.
And what about on building works?
So building works, it depends what it is. So there's a slightly different rule on the capital goods scheme. So normal building works would probably be classed as services, and so it's the 6 months rule. But where building works cost more than £250,000 plus VAT, they fall within what's called the capital goods scheme. And under the capital goods scheme, you monitor the use of that asset for a period of 10 years. And that's what a lot of the schools are doing now. So if they had a new swimming pool, for example, put in 4 years ago, they're now registering for VAT. They can actually get 6/10 of the VAT back, because you're looking at it over a 10-year period. So you wouldn't get it all back in one go, but they would get 1/10 of the VAT back every year until those 10 years have expired.
Here's one other one, and then maybe put some over to Jamie. But here's a pop quiz question. I'm self-employed. So as a self-employed person, I'm registered for VAT.
Yeah.
If I charge my electric car at a Tesco or a service station, I can reclaim the 20% VAT, just like I can reclaim the VAT on fuel. But if I charge it at home, I can't reclaim the 5%. Is that right?
There have been a lot of petitions to the government about this, and they released some guidance, and then they unreleased some guidance, and then they released some different guidance. And I think the answer is they just don't have a clear plan as to what they think the rules.
Meanwhile, if you get it right, get it wrong, you're subject to automatic fines and penalty notices.
And that's the difficulty. And you have to go back 4 years to correct errors as well. So yeah, there's a lot of business, especially as, you know, you're talking about sustainability and things like that, especially as electric car use is going up, businesses want certainty, they want clarity on what they need to do. So there is some guidance, but it's a bit wishy-washy.
I was just going to say, just take before from the sort of perspective of selling goods and things like that, there's always calls again for different VAT rates for things, you know, or things that should be zero rated for VAT. What's your view on, because the more you do, the more complicated it is, whether that helps or not. So should there be like a staged or VAT levels for different things?
It would be a lot simpler if it was all the same rate. So I'm a member of the VAT practitioners group, which is as exciting as it sounds. It's a group full of VAT specialists. So we all get together and we talk about all things VAT. And at our conference last year, there were a couple of representatives from HMRC there. specifically to ask VAT people what we thought would simplify VAT, what would make it easier for businesses. And we all said it's those different rates that cause the problems. Because, I mean, food is a really good one. You have Jaffa cakes. If it's a chocolate-covered biscuit, it's VAT-able. If it's a chocolate-covered cake, it's zero-rated. It's the distinction isn't always easy. And all of the problems, all of the difficulties, well, not all of them, but most of the difficulties are caused where you have something which could fall on either side of that line. So what we should do, I think, is have VAT on almost everything, but at a lower rate.
Yeah.
Because it's always the first thing that's called for. Hospitality says, you know, dinner, food, if you eat out, should be at 0 or 5%, and drinks should be at this and that. And so it gets everybody out and doing stuff. But it would just be more complicated for them to administer.
It's more complicated, and it's the cost as well. So I was at a conference last year. We were celebrating 50 years of VAT. So we've had VAT since 1973. And the head of HMRC at the time was speaking, and someone asked him about all the things, because one of the things that people were trying to try and make Brexit sound as if it was actually a good idea was that we could make our own rules when it came to VAT. We didn't have to follow the EU. So they said, everyone has given you these ideas for what we can do. Now we can do anything. And he said, the trouble is, if we agreed to everything that people have suggested, it would cost £150 billion.
Yes.
But we make about £180 billion from VAT. So that's nearly all of that gone. Grant everybody's wish.
Going back to the legacy of the VAT, or where it started from in 1973, it was dreamt up, as I recall, from my political days by a French economist.
Yes,
in order to fund
the EU. It's 70 years older this year.
Yes.
It was 1954.
Yes, and it was all in order to feed the emerging iron and steel community, the EU as it was in those days. And it wasn't supposed to be a general sales tax. In Canada, they have a general sales tax, which is what you're just advocating, a sales tax and everything. It's supposed to be for things that add value to your life, not things that are essential to live on. But it's crept, hasn't it? What is interesting is that the EU takes top slices. I think it's 5% of all VAT, and thereafter it's up to individual EU states what they charge. So you got the issue of your trading abroad of VAT. Now, I don't know. I'm not going to embarrass you, Andy, to ask about your VAT relationships, but software is one of these things we buy at Recognition PR from American firms. They tend to then be registered in Ireland, and then the VAT comes through in an odd way.
You have to do it under the reverse charge.
And it's crazy. Well, it isn't crazy. It's logical, but it's more complex for something such a cheap thing like a subscription to a piece of software that's maybe 15 quid a month.
Yeah, and that is one of the difficulties, particularly, as we're saying, VAT is quite old. The legislation was written 50 years ago. It doesn't reflect the way the world works now. And the EU have been working on e-invoicing, which they've just agreed last week is going to happen, is going to be in place by 2030. So all businesses, every invoice they raise has to be in this e-invoice format. And I think the intention is it will go to the tax authority as it is issued. And so you're doing real-time reporting.
That is news.
Of every transaction. We're not in the EU. If we want to trade with the EU, which we obviously do, we're going to have to do it. So we need to do some catching up, because we've announced a consultation that's starting in January.
It's fascinating and horrific at the same time.
But that's one of the things that we need something which covers all countries. And part of the problem at the moment is that e-invoicing is being brought in quite a few different countries, but they're all doing it differently.
Yeah.
And actually finding out how it's going to work cross-border is going to be challenging. I'm glad I'm not in charge of doing that.
Andy, you can say no, but have you got anything to comment on this when it comes to trade? Do you trade from Manchester with 20% VAT, or is it...
You were very kind in not going direct with any VAT questions on me earlier. Now you've gone straight in on one. But... I'll stick to the subject matter that I know.
You definitely gave us the right answers. Well, look, Hilary, Andy, thank you. Thanks, Jamie.
That's been great. Thank you. Thanks,
if you want to be on the Northern Business Podcast, do get in touch with us. You can get in touch with Recognition PR on LinkedIn. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks to the podcast producers and also to Robin Campbell, our technical operator. Join us next time for the Law of the Business podcast. Don't miss episodes. You can like, rate or subscribe on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts.